You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, can be won, many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by United Steelworkers Local 12561 and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Local 1464. IBEW Local 1464 reminds all union members to support each other and encourage all workers to buy union and American-made products. And bringing you quality service and safe natural gas from USW Local 12561, serving Kansas Gas Service and Missouri Gas Energy customers. We thank our underwriters for their support to the Heartland Labor Forum and to KKFI. On tonight's show, Labor History in 2 Minutes a Day, we talk to Stephanie Sewell of the Illinois Labor History Society about the new radio show called Labor History in 2. Then, the government of Venezuela regularly gets bad press in the U.S. media. We'll get the other side from Venezuela's Consul General in Chicago and also ask him about the growing movement of worker co-ops that are building a solidarity economy. In the news, fast-track vote to be on Friday. And finally, Rana Plaza victims in Bangladesh get compensation 2 years late. Now for the news.
After 2 years of campaigning and over 1 million people pushing for it, Bangladeshi workers who were victims of the horrific Rana Plaza building collapse have finally won full compensation. The International Labor Rights Forum announced yesterday that the pressure on corporations and the appeals to nonprofits and foundations has succeeded in securing $30 million in compensation for the victims. The Rana Plaza collapse on April 24, 2013, was the deadliest disaster in the history of the global garment industry. It killed at least 1,138 people and injured another 2,500. Judy Gearhart, executive director of the International Labor Rights Forum, said, "This campaign victory would not have been possible without the hard work of workers' rights groups and labor unions on the ground in Bangladesh, and activism from a wide variety of allies around the world who held more than 100 store actions and demonstrations at corporate headquarters." Bangladesh lacks a national workplace injury compensation program, and so, in the wake of the tragedy, workers' rights advocates united in calling on the apparel brands and retailers whose clothes were produced at Rana Plaza to pay full and fair compensation to the injured survivors and the families of the deceased. The United Nations International Labor Organization, ILO, set up the Rana Plaza Trust Fund in January 2014 to collect funds to cover loss of income and medical expenses for Rana Plaza victims and their families. In November 2014, the Rana Plaza Coordination Committee announced that it would need $30 million to pay awards to 5,000 claimants under the scheme. The corporate donors, including donations from Gap Foundation, Hudson's Bay Company, The Children's Place, VF Foundation, Walmart, and Walmart Foundation, gave a total of only $2,488,000, although Children's Place gave an additional $2,050,000.
Most of the world's workers have insecure jobs, a new ILO report reveals. The International Labor Organization says only a quarter of workers are on permanent jobs. A global shift to more insecure jobs since the financial crisis is fueling growing inequality and higher rates of poverty, they say, and three-quarters of the world's workers are employed on temporary or short-term contracts, working informally, often without any contract, are self-employed, or are in unpaid family jobs. The report, The World Employment and Social Outlook 2015, says that a worldwide trend away from secure jobs risks perpetuating a vicious circle of weak global demand and slow job creation. It finds a rise in part-time employment, especially among young women. Though some workers welcome the flexibility of part-time jobs and self-employment, often such roles are down to lack of choice, it said. The report's main author, Raymond Torres, noted that in developing countries, wage and salaried work was growing at a slower pace than before the crisis, while in advanced economies, such jobs were not growing and were declining in some cases. There are signs of declining employment security in high-income countries since the financial crisis, Torres said, flagging up the rise of self-employment, of workers without contracts, and those who were involuntarily working part-time. The report drew a link between widespread insecurity at work and rising income inequality in many countries. The income gap between permanent and non-permanent workers has increased over the past decade, it said. The ILO is urging policymakers to consider extending social protection, such as pensions and unemployment benefit, to workers in less secure forms of employment. It said that globally, only 16% of the self-employed were part of a pension scheme, compared with 52% of employees. Torres cited Chile, China, and Brazil as examples of countries that were moving towards great social protection for the self-employed, and said that the evidence suggested such policies did not harm employment rates.
Most observers are saying that the fast-track TPP vote in Congress is too close to call. Republican leaders are planning final votes on fast-track and other trade measures in the House this Friday. Unions and their allies increased their campaign to get lawmakers to reject the Obama GOP fast-track scheme to grease the skids for future secret trade pacts, especially the Trans-Pacific Partnership. In rallies, print and media ads, personal postings, emails, phone calls, and marches, unionists, community and religious groups, the NAACP, environmentalists, and more made it clear that fast track aids only the corporate class while hurting workers and everybody else. Besides the emails, marches, and protests, unions set up a toll-free number, 855-712-8441, for calls to Congress. Notices this week from Public Citizens report that of the Missouri delegation, only Representatives Emmanuel Cleaver and Lacey Clay has stated that they vote against it. Sam Graves is on the fence. And in Kansas, Kevin Yoder snickered this week when he told people at a picnic last Saturday, "I'm supporting your president. Aren't you happy with that?" So count him as a yes.
Mary Harris Mother Jones has been a symbol of the struggles and victories of the labor movement for over a century. Mother Jones was a fearless fighter for workers' rights and was once labeled the most dangerous woman in America. Why? She fought for everyone's rights, and her organizing efforts include women, minorities, and children. And she spent time in jail several times because of her commitment to working men and women. She was quoted as saying, "If they want to hang me, let them. And on the scaffold, I will shout, 'Freedom for the working class.'" Mother Jones is buried about 60 miles south of Springfield, Illinois, in Mount Olive, just off Interstate 55 on the road between St. Louis and Chicago. She died in 1930 at age 100 and was buried with her miners in the Union Miner Cemetery. But for decades, her monument and the cemetery have needed restoration. With the help of the Illinois AFL-CIO, State Senator Andrew Manner, who helped secure a grant from the Illinois Department of Economic Opportunity and many others, the project began 2 years ago. After much hard work since then, the Mother Jones Foundation finally realized their dreams. Enough money was raised and the restoration was completed last month. A rededication ceremony is scheduled for June 20th at 10 a.m. at the Mount Olive Cemetery. The rededication coincides with the 150th celebration of the city of Mount Olive. The event will include unveiling of the monument and special recognition of donors, music, refreshments, and speakers. While the Mother Jones Monument has been restored, money is needed for its continuing upkeep. Donations can be sent to Mother Jones Monument Fund at the Illinois AFL-CIO, 534 South 2nd Street, Springfield, Illinois, 62701. The news this evening has been read by Ariana Eckel, Jen Zaman, Michael Savoy, and I'm Greg Schwartz.
Miner's life is like a sailor's board a ship to cross the waves. Every day his life's in danger, still he ventures, being brave. Watch the rocks, they're falling daily. Careless miners always fail. Keep your hand upon the dollar and your eye upon the scale. Union miners, stand together, heed no operator's tale. Keep your hand upon the dollar and your eye upon the scale.
Good evening. For this evening on the Heartland Labor Forum, we have a very interesting guest. We have someone who is with the Illinois Labor History Society, and her name is Stephanie. Stephanie, welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum.
Thank you for having me.
I did a little more research on this. You have a new organization and a new radio segment, but it started out with something that's been going on since 2005, isn't it? With Rick Smith.
Yes, it's the Rick Smith radio show out of Pennsylvania.
And does he have a labor history?
Yeah, he comes out of labor, and then he moved over into to do radio because he wanted to share worker stories, both contemporary worker stories and the important labor history.
Was he in a union before?
I'm not sure about that, to be honest. I think he might have been part of the Teamsters, but I'm not sure about that.
I think you're right on that one. You and I spoke earlier and said that this just began in January of 2015, and it's called Labor History in 2 Minutes. Is that correct?
Yeah, Labor History in Two. Yes. And basically, it's a 2-minute podcast that shares a story from today in labor history. So most of the stories are from the United States, but we even go overseas for some of our labor history stories.
And who do you work with to create this?
So how it works is I write the script and do the research and put each piece together, and then I send that over to Rick, the radio host, and he does some edits, you know, makes it more sound like something for radio, and I might suggest a song clip or something that he might use, and then he might pick some things. He picks a photo or an image that goes with the story, and then he uploads it, he records it, and he uploads it on Facebook and on Podbean, a podcast site.
How long have you worked with him?
So I have only been the director of the Illinois Labor History Society since this October. And when I took the job early on, our board president, Larry Spivak, who comes out of AFSCME, he and Rick had talked about doing a podcast on labor history for a while. And so I called Rick, and we started talking, and then I started working on them, started writing some of the scripts in December, and we actually didn't meet until March. So we worked together for a few months before we actually had a chance to meet when he visited Chicago.
Well, and Chicago is a wonderful place to go to as well, wonderful, rich labor history. Did you get involved with labor because of your family, or was it for another reason?
So I don't come from a family with a lot of labor background. My grandfather worked for Ford in Ohio, and was a member of the union there, but labor wasn't really something we talked a lot about. I got involved in labor myself personally when I was a graduate student working on my history PhD at the University of Illinois. I ended up being the treasurer of our local, which is an AFT local, and then I was on the strike bargaining committee. We ended up going out on strike. I was on the strike committee, and then the year after that, I was the president of my local, and was very involved in my local until I graduated with my degree last spring.
Well, I was have to ask, were you on the picket line?
Oh, definitely. I was on the picket line. My job for the picket line was hospitality. So I marched. I also, you know, made sure that people had hand warmers and granola bars. And my friend David and I walked up and down the lines with coffee because we were on strike and it was a miserable, rainy, cold November. So, yeah, I was basically on the picket line, except for when I had to go and be in the bargaining room.
And all of that is really important work. That had to be a real crash course for you.
It was. The one great thing about a graduate local like ours, we have some staff, but we're mostly run by volunteers, and so, you know, you get to kind of do everything. So as part of my local, I did everything from go to Springfield and our capital and talk about legislation that we wanted passed, to write press releases, to hold rallies, to throw Halloween parties. I mean, I really got a sort of crash course on labor, got to do a little bit of everything.
Well, is the work that you do available to everyone?
You mean the podcast?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they're definitely. One of the reasons that we're doing this is because one of the things we like to say a lot at the Illinois Labor History Society, we're the oldest popular labor history society in the United States, and we've been going since 1969, and this is a new initiative for us. And one of the things we say all the time is, if we don't tell the worker story, who will? And Rick Smith also really subscribes to that. And so for both Rick and I, it's really important that this gets out. We're really excited on the different platforms that we have this available. Over the podcasts have been downloaded over 100,000 times since January, but we know we're just scratching the tip of the iceberg. So, you know, we encourage unions, if they're interested, to contact me. I could send them the link, and, you know, they could put it up on their website. We have a Facebook page, and, you know, we want people to join the Facebook page. You know, you can listen to it on your phone, on your commute, you know, on your way to work. I listen to it every day on the L when I'm driving in because I like to hear how it sounds once Rick records it. So, yeah, we're really strongly encouraging. What we want this to be is a tool for the labor movement, for working people. You know, everybody has 2 minutes a day. And we try to keep the episodes as fun as possible and as engaging as possible so that people could learn about all sorts of different labor history.
When I went online and I just typed it in, and because I don't do a lot of things on my phone, but I did on my computer, and I loved the pictures, and mm-hmm. I loved the information, and I loved having it written, too, so I could just read it. And where do those pictures come from?
So Rick finds all the art and the images that, you know, he finds things that he thinks illustrate each story and selects those. And I do think that, you know, having that visual along with the sound really helps tell the story. And a lot of times, you know, he finds pictures that illustrate the kind of things that I'm talking about while I'm putting these together. And it's a great partnership. We, you know, creatively and we just work really well together.
And one of the things I was really surprised is that it's a different story every day. You choose a different individual to feature every single day. And, boy, you've got something for every work group.
That's really important to me. You know, what I try to do is go back and look at the items that I've selected and make sure that I'm not focusing too much on one union or, you know, one type of worker. I'm really, you know, trying to tell Latino worker stories and Black worker stories and women's worker stories. You know, we've told several parts of LGBT labor history. Different regions of the country. You know, there's labor history in the South of the United States, and we don't talk about that enough. I try to go as far back. I think we did one story that goes all the way back into right before the Revolutionary War. And then, you know, I've had stories that go into the 2000s because I think it's important for us to think about how what's happening now is eventually going to be part of labor's history. And we always, in the episodes, as much as possible, try to bring connections to the struggle and to what's happening in labor today, because history isn't past. It speaks to the movements and what's happening and facing workers today. And that's the reason, ultimately, we're doing this, is to empower workers and let them know about the stories and the rich history that comes before us.
These pieces are so well done. I have to ask, how long does it take for you to create one?
Well, I've gotten faster. One of the great things is that Rick has compiled a list of potential stories, and I with a sentence about each one, or a few words about each one, and I usually start with that. Sometimes I branch off in different directions. At first, it was taking me 2 hours or something like that, but now it takes me about an hour. We have an extensive library here at the Illinois Labor History Society, so I have a lot of books at my fingertips, but I also do a lot of online research.
When I was on there, you can look at more than just the one that you have on there for today. And I could have been lost in there all day long with it. And how far back can I go? Can I go back clear to what you have had there in January?
Yes, you could go all the way back to January 1st. I think that they've gotten stronger and better as we've gone along and kind of gotten used to the format. But yeah, you could go all the way back to January 1st, and hopefully we're going to keep this going after this year, and you'll be able, what we'd like to do is, do it again, but have a different story, because a lot of days it's been hard to pick, from the rich history, which event I wanted, or, which birth of an important labor figure I wanted to discuss. Yeah, you could. Hopefully, you'll be able to go back even further than a year.
And I this afternoon, after we spoke, I had visited with a retired teacher from NEA, and she still works at her union office. And she said, "Well, can you find me a story about teachers? Have you done one about the teachers that you can remember?"
One that we've done, in fact, and I would like to do some more about teachers. There's some stories that I have in mind, but the dates for them haven't come up yet. We did one on the a really interesting story about the formation of the New York Teachers Union, and it starts that story starts with some junior high teachers, and their bosses were actually going so far as hiding in the bushes and spying on them with binoculars, and they started getting together and discussing, forming a stronger teachers union, and they'd bring a guitar and they met at somebody's house, and slowly from that was built the New York Teachers Union that we have today. The other thing I think that's really interesting is I try to bring modern voices into the stories, and for whatever reason, the AFT current national president Randy Weingarten is always good for a good quote in the newspaper. So there's been several stories that I've done. I did one on the Moral Monday movement in North Carolina, and one of the quotes I selected was from Randy, from President Weingarten, just because she often has some good things to say to the media. But there will be some more teachers ones coming up. There might be more even now. I might be forgetting some, but I have my eye on a few.
Which also, I wondered, after all of these that you read and you make choices of, do you have one or two that were your favorites?
What I like to, there's a lot of them that I really enjoy the ones that have to do with art that comes out of the labor movement. So, we tell the backstory of when Woody Guthrie wrote This Land Is Your Land, or, when the backstory of movies like Matuan or Grapes of Wrath, things of that nature, Salt of the Earth, that film that they're trying to make and people are shooting at the car because they don't want this labor story to be told. But I think the thing that are the most exciting and interesting to me are sort of the unexpected stories. So there's one of what is called the first woman coal miner out of Ohio named Ida Mae Stahl. And, she just wants to mine coal. She actually owns part of the mine. It's on her property. And the mine inspector comes and says, women can't be in the mines. And so she knows he's coming, so she saves up rotten eggs and puts them in her coal wheelbarrow when he comes. in her coal cart, and she's throwing eggs at him. And, you know, he gets her out of the mine, but she takes him, you know, takes them to court, and she actually wins the right to go back and mine because she owns the mine. And they finally say, all right, you can go back. Or another one that was one of my very favorites, there was a strike on Boeing in 2000 in Seattle, and people were shocked that these white-collar workers went out on strike. And, you know, the strike got really creative. It was primarily engineers and people that did that kind of work, and they made picket signs that said things like, no nerds, no birds, and... Then they, you know, they had burn barrels because it was cold while they were out, you know, walking the picket lines. And one of the tactics that management did is they got the burn barrel shut down because they said they didn't meet EPA regulations. Well, they didn't reckon that they were dealing with engineers. So one of the engineers designs a burn barrel that gives off really low emissions and can pass EPA standards. And so it was used in that strike, and now it's been used in other strikes. So that kind of worker creativity, whether it's in the film or how workers tell their stories, participate and build solidarity in ways that are unexpected and exciting, defend themselves, I like the stories about, you know, major unions and major strikes and things that, you know, we all hear about, and, you know, from Haymarket to the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. I mean, we cover all those really well-known events, but what I really like is when I stumble on a story that's less known in a region or with a group of people that we might not expect to go out on strike. You know, black women nurses in the Carolinas, things like that. Those are the stories that really get me excited.
That brings me to another point. Is every labor group, everybody who's been in a strike or not a strike, but had some kind of a work action, they have stories, and they're regional. And I just wonder, is there a place for our listeners who might have a good story where how they could send it to you to be for consideration?
I would love it because, I mean, you know, as much as I dig and as much as I look around, at the end of the day, you know, this is only one part of a really busy job that I have directing the Illinois Labor History Society, and I'm sure that there's stories I miss or stories that I don't hear about or haven't come to my attention. So if people have labor history stories, even if they've, you know, happened between January and today, because I've already written those, they could submit them because, you know, next year I'm going to be looking for more stories. They can send them to me at Illinois Labor History Society, and our email is ilhs@prodigy.net.
Okay. We'll make sure we'll have that on our website so that people can, as they're thinking this evening or maybe this weekend, that they'll be thinking of some old stories. I can think of one where we were on strike, probably about 8 years ago, and with CWA, and a manager got mad because one of the people marching didn't move fast enough for him, and he actually hit her with his truck. You don't think about those things happening as much as, you know, as they used to, but they still do.
Oh, yeah, and one of the ones that's coming up here pretty soon was out of the Justice, I don't think it's hit the air yet, out of the Justice for Janitors campaign in the earlier 2000s, where, you know, the police broke up the strike and beat one woman so badly that she suffered a miscarriage. And, you know, it's another one I just recently wrote, again, that's coming up, is about the Pinkerton detectives coming in and shutting down a computer company because it had filed Chapter 11 bankruptcy. And, you know, the Pinkertons come in and kick everybody out and lock the doors, and the workers don't even know what's happening. Well, I didn't even, you know, you hear about the Pinkerton detectives all the time and coal mining and railroad strikes, but apparently they're still working for the bosses. And, you know, it's really amazing how many themes, you know, from the 1890s, I find still happening when I write some of the 2000s stories.
And Stephanie, when we spoke earlier, you said that you wanted to encourage people to like you on Facebook, is there something
definitely
tied to that?
Like
numbers?
Us on Facebook. If you're a union or an organization that has a website and you would like to have a link to the stories, you know, to put up on your website. We have that. It's a slightly more complicated code, but you could send, you know, an email to me, and I can get that to you. But the purpose of this, the reason we're doing this, if you, like, for example, your radio show, or if there's any other labor radio shows or any kind of community shows, and you want to play the podcast, you know, even if it's just on the day that you're on the air, you can get, we are really glad to share those with you. They're available on the Pacifica Network, where, you know, they've been picked up by the National Steelwork, U.S. Steel website. I've seen it on Daily Cost a few times. The goal for this is that, you know, that people will pick them up.
Okay. Well, it looks like this is our time. I've had a wonderful time with you, Stephanie Sewell, and I hope that if you ever come to Kansas City, you'll come visit us at our studio.
For sure, and I'm looking forward to getting some good stories out of Kansas City so that I can include them in labor history, too.
We'll promise it. Okay. Well, thank you very much, and it was wonderful hearing about the story, and people will be listening to your special history, two-minute history for labor.
Thank you so much. Thanks for the opportunity to talk to you, and keep up the good work.
Thanks.
Bye.
8 years we bravely battled Bush, that smug, self-righteous frat boy on a bender.
Boy on a bender.
We marched against his endless war, we rallied every race and class and gender.
Every gender.
Our hearts were new, our states were blue, our aim was true, and yet we always missed him.
Too bad we missed him.
Perhaps our problem stemmed from our acceptance of this filthy, rotten system. Yeah! We caucused, called, and canvassed for Barack, raised cash and voter registration.
Registration.
Triumphantly we tuned into debate, acceptance speech, inauguration.
Inauguration.
Joe Biden felt he talked so well, and when Obama won, I could have kissed him.
I want to kiss him.
But don't our problems stem from our acceptance of this filthy, rotten system? Yeah. Then, having vanquished Bush and Darth, we all returned to home and hearth and cable.
Returned to cable.
We thought we'd crash the party, but we ain't even sitting at the table.
Not at the table.
Now corporate flacks and party hacks surround Barack, all eager to assist him.
They will assist him.
Do you think our problems stem from our acceptance of this filthy, rotten system?
Yeah. Hi, that was Charlie King and Kieran Brandau with The Problem Is This Dirty, Rotten System. So that's an interesting introduction to what we're going to talk about. I'm Judy Ansel. And a couple of months ago, President Obama declared that Venezuela is an unusual and extraordinary threat to the security of the United States. The media cheered him on. For over a decade, the U.S. has undermined the Venezuelan government, tried to overthrow it, threatened sanctions. Really? Venezuela? This doesn't make much sense, or does it? You know, we get a ton of oil from them. We could have hoped that the U.S. media could have been more balanced and taken at least a little bit of a critical eye on all of this, but alas, they just parrot what the administration says. And since the media is consistently hostile to the Bolivarian government in Venezuela, and only the alternative media like Democracy Now! Or The Real News gives us a counter view, we thought the Heartland Labor Forum might do this too. Because Venezuela has been doing some extraordinary things as far as employment and worker empowerment is going in Latin America. So we contacted the Venezuelan Consul General in Chicago. His name is Jesus Rodriguez, and he agreed to be on the show. He was appointed Consul General in 2008. Before that, he was Deputy Consul General for 3 years. He has a degree in international relations. He worked in the Ministry of Science and Technology under the Hugo Chavez government and has been a supporter of that government and now of the Maduro government for a long time. And I want to welcome you to the show, Jesus Rodriguez.
Hi, thank you for inviting us. I don't know you, but I hear something like a noise.
Are you there?
You hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you fine. Yeah.
Okay, now I hear it fine.
Oh, good. Okay. Let's talk about the media first, the U.S. media's treatment of Venezuela. Do you agree that it's pretty hostile?
Yes, of course, yes. I always, whenever someone asks me about that, I always refer to the time when I first was appointed to the U.S. here in Chicago in 2005. And my first, 12 or 18 months, we were able to track the number of bad articles or news coverage about Venezuela in the media, here in the Midwest at least. But after 2006, we quit doing that because the number of bad media about Venezuela surpass our capabilities. So that's to tell you, to give you an idea on how things have changed since then. And part of the our counting of bad coverage is part of what consulates or embassies usually do as their regular work. You know what I mean?
Right. You track the media and you try to present a positive image.
But in 2006, we quit doing that, at least in the consulate. I know that the people in the embassy still do those things, but we quit doing that.
Well, let's take an example.
So that gives you an idea of how things are.
Yeah. Let's take an example. When we talked earlier, you talked about the student protests last year in which a number of people died. Talk about what the media says and then talk about what actually happened.
Yes. I was about to mention you that, the last thing that shows what happened between Venezuela and the media, not only in the U.S., but the mass media all over the world that is controlled by by a small number of people, basically. So the U.S. is not an exception. But what happened in 2014, which were riots promoted by the right wing in Venezuela that we call guarimbas, and that here in the U.S. media they call it a peaceful student protest. I put quotations always when I refer to that. Basically, they put us in one of the worst public relations moments that we have had ever in history. And basically what they portray us, they use that situation to portray us like the worst dictatorship and repressive government in the world, something like that. And basically what happened is that a group of right-wing politicians that led some legitimate protesters provoke riots and attack property and people in Venezuela, and that led to the killing of 41 people in a time frame of 3 or 4 months of riots in different places in the country, especially places controlled by opposition mayors in the country.
Yeah, I remember reading that the protesters set up barricades that blockaded streets. And
yes.
Yeah, and what happened with that?
Yes, that's part of the numbers that I wanted to mention you. Basically, 41 people die, but out of... actually, the most updated number is 43, And out of those three, 11 belong to law enforcement officers, and like 20 were pacifiers or even Chavista people trying to pass through the barricades or even wires that the opposition protest, the right-wing protest, put in the middle of the street, and some of them decapitate some of the bike riders and things like that. So people die like that. So actually there's like around one quarter of the people that died during those protests could actually be counted as opposition protesters. So that's to give you an idea on how, you know, the media twists reality and portray us like the Venezuelan government killed 43 people, which is absolutely the opposite.
So they were reported as being student protesters. Were they actually students, and what were they protesting?
Yes, that's also some numbers that I have that has been addressed recently, and it's important to highlight that during those days in Venezuela, I'm talking about 2014, like more than 3,000 people were put in jail. A few weeks later, only 180 of them remain in jail because they commit a crime or we had proofs to demonstrate their crimes or things like that. Only 17 out of those 180 were students. That gives you an idea on the number of students involved in the most current number updated recently says that we only right now have 79 out of those 180 of last year, only 39 remain in jail, and only one of them is a student. So that gives you an idea of how the judicial system has been working around a particular issue. And it's important to highlight that out of those 39 that I'm mentioning you, 14 are law enforcement officers that were involved in excesses in Venezuela, different than in other places around the world. We put policemen in jail.
Well, that's certainly different from the U.S. let's talk about the changes that were made, that were initiated by the Chavez government, and I assume are being continued by the Maduro government. And then let's talk about why there's this intense opposition to it. But first, talk about what some of the major changes are, particularly for poor and working people.
Yes, if you ask me, I believe that one of the most important changes that were introduced by Chavez was to give people dignity. I mean, Venezuelan people have changed a lot 1998, when Chavez first took power, but the biggest change was promoted by Chavez in a sense of empowering those Venezuelans that always were forgotten by the previous governments that only ruled for the minority, for the elites. So in that sense, Venezuela has changed dramatically and for good, if you ask me, because that people right now are there defending their rights and trying to protect the achievement. And what are those achievements? The right to have public health, which might sound like not a big deal here in the U.S., or maybe it is, but for countries like Latin American countries, it's a big deal. And Chavez, one of the biggest achievements was a social program called Misión Barrio Adentro, with the help of the Cuban government, through that program, distribute or put like thousands of doctors all over Venezuela to provide first level medical attention in the poorest shanty towns in Venezuela. And that was something miraculous because most of the Venezuelan population that live under poverty never had the chance to visit a doctor before and to receive medicines for free during their visit to the doctor, and even though that doctor in that program live in the neighborhood and they can reach him 24/7. So it was a dramatic change in how, you know, the government provides services to the people. That's one of the big.
Okay.
Yes, no,
I'm wondering, do you have problems with your phones at the Venezuelan consulate in Chicago?
I don't know, but I'm listening like a small lack of audio. I have my cell phone with me if you need.
Well, you could try to call us back on your cell phone. I can give you the number.
Okay, let me do it.
We'll just put some music on for a minute. The number is
816-931-5534.
And when you come back,
5534.
And when you come back, we're going to ask you about what are some of the other gains
that
the Chavez government made. Okay.
That's fine. I'm calling you right away.
Okay, thanks.
816-931-5534.
That's right.
Okay.
Thanks.
I got the light of freedom deep down in my heart. I've got the light of freedom deep down in my heart. And it's deep, deep, and it's down, down, and it's deep down in my heart. And it's deep, deep, and it's down, down, and it's deep down in my heart. Ain't that the light of freedom? Deep down in my heart. Ain't that the light of freedom? Deep down in my heart. And it is deep, deep, and it's down, down, and it's deep down in my heart. And it's deep, deep, and it's down, down, and it's deep down in my heart. I got the fire of justice deep down in my heart. I got the fire of justice deep down in my heart. And it's deep, deep, and it's down, down, and it's deep down in my heart. And it's deep, deep, and it's down, down, and it's deep down in my heart. I see a new day dawning deep down in my heart.
Okay, we're
back. I believe
back.
That. Okay, now
you,
I hear you.
You sound so much better.
Much better.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, I would check your phones there in the consulate.
Yes, maybe it's our phone system. I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway, okay. So you talked about the healthcare and the Cuban doctors. Would you talk a little bit, just briefly, about the housing program? Because we don't have a lot of time left.
Yes, that's something relatively new. We initiated that like in 2010 or 2011, and we initiated that because the government realized after like surveys and consulting with the people that was one of the biggest, problems for Venezuela population. So Chavez initiated a massive program of housing. I believe that it was, we are right now in the third year, and we have built more than 700,000 houses all over the country. And those are houses that are provided not under the capitalist free market, rules, but under the rules of a socialist government that understand the particular social conditions of each Venezuelan and provide them with facilities to pay those houses and to have the proper financing of those houses. And basically, we have been making like more than 200,000 houses per year in a country with only 30 million people. So I believe that's a big number, and President Maduro has announced that this year he wants to finish 2015 with the house number 1 million.
Wow.
So I believe that's going to happen,
okay.
Even though we are facing right now complicated economic situation associated to the fact that we are an oil economy and that the oil prices are going down, and that affects us a lot.
Okay, so... You know, you also reformed the labor law and gave workers more rights, but I don't want to take a lot of time to go into that because I really want you to talk about why is it that you think that the U.S. government is so hostile to the government of Venezuela?
I believe that because of the ghost of the communist ghost, if you ask me, is somehow related to that and whatever smells to, you know, progressive socialist or communist for a lot of people, not only in the U.S., but all over the world, creates this phenomena of, like, threat or something. And the fact is that we are trying to build our own path to socialism, not copying recipes from like, the orthodoxy. And I believe that because of that, I mean, the U.S., look at us as a threat because we might be a bad example for other countries in the region, actually, if you ask me. And if you analyze the historical facts, you will see that when Chavez took power in 98, he was the only one talking about, socialism in a continent that was under control of the neoliberal, dictations of the International Monetary Fund. So a few years later, those things have changed. And actually, I'm happy because of that, because, I mean, not because Chavez exports socialism, but because the people of Latin America realize that there can be countries that can do things different, especially respecting and providing services to the people that really need those services in our countries, which are mostly the poor people. And thankfully, those things have empowered, I believe, other countries around the world, not only Latin America. We can talk about Spain or Greece, actually.
Do you think all of this would have been possible if Venezuela didn't have such great resources in oil? Would the U.S. have already overthrown your government if that was the case?
That's a good question. A lot of people say so. But if you ask me, a lot of people that criticize us, even friends from the left, said that we have achieved those things because we have a lot of income from the oil. But the truth is that when we initiate the most massive and important social programs that Chavez initiated, we did it in 2003. I'm talking a few months after the coup d'etat that tried to ask Chavez from the power that was led by the right-wing forces in 2002. So and they a few months later they promote a oil strike basically stopped the oil production in the country, and the economy of Venezuela was terribly affected. So we didn't have too much money, and besides that, we initiated Misión Barrio Adentro, which is the health mission that I mentioned before, and Mission Robinson, which was the social program that helped us to eliminate, eradicate illiteracy, also with the help of Cuban. And those missions, those social programs, didn't require a lot of money because they were based on the work of the organized communities. Mm-hmm. For example, in the case of the health program, the doctors that came from Cuba, they live in the houses of the neighbors in the poorest shanty towns, and they organize themselves to accommodate the best way and to provide them with the right space for them to work. And that didn't require too much money. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So whenever someone asks me about that, I tell them that because it's a fact. This is true. I mean, we didn't need too much money. And whenever you work with the community and with the grassroots organizations, you always are going to be able to do things if you really want to do those things, of course.
Well, okay. We're talking to Jesus Rodriguez Espinosa, who is the Venezuelan Consul General based in Chicago. And we only have two more minutes. And I wanted to be sure to ask you about the empresas de producción social, the social production companies in Venezuela, which is another form of socialism that's being built. And can you really briefly just let people know what that is?
Yes, a lot of people, especially progressive people, when they talk about production, they refer a lot about co-ops. And we promote co-ops a lot in Venezuela, especially between 1999 and 2000, maybe three or four.
You're talking about co-ops, right? Cooperatives.
The co-ops, yes, right now. But since 2007 or 8, we start talking in Venezuela about what you mentioned, empresas de producción social. And it's basically taking the concept of communal councils, that is organized community trying to solve the problems forward. And basically, we are giving the tools to organize communities or communal councils, as we call them, for production. So in that sense, we have initiated several projects that basically transferred completely or partially the property of some enterprises that previously were controlled by the state to the organized communities. And in that sense, we are trying to avoid becoming state capitalism, but at the same time, we are providing the organized communities with their tools to achieve their goals. For example, President Chavez nationalized around 2010 the telecommunication company in Venezuela. And it's a big company that was in hands of Verizon, I believe.
Verizon.
And a few years later, the call center for that particular company, Cantv, was put in the hands of communal councils that create an empresa de producción social.
Well,
and right now, that communal council that is in the city of Mexico is the major shareholder of that call center that was created to transfer the control of the means of production directly to the people without the intermediation of the state, which I believe is great. So we have been doing experiments like that, and the revenues of their work go directly to their communities to solve their problems directly, to build houses, to fix their streets. And I believe, if you ask me, that that's the best example of the socialism that we are trying to promote in Venezuela.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. We are out of time. Thank you so much. We're going to have to get back sometime with you and talk about the progress of those things, because that's really fascinating. Thanks so much, Jesus Rodriguez, for being on the Heartland Labor Forum.
Thank you for inviting us.
Okay, bye-bye. Okay, and now for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. We don't have much time. You can find it on our webpage, heartlandlaborforum.org, where you can find our archived shows. But on Monday, June 15th, celebrate Justice for Janitors Day. It's the 25th anniversary of the Justice for Janitors campaign of SEIU, and this will be at Kindred Hospital Northland at 11:45 a.m., 500 Northwest 68th Street in Kansas City. And the Workers' Rights Intake Clinic for Victims of Wage Theft is on Monday also from 5 to 8 p.m. at El Centro, 650 Minnesota Avenue, Kansas City, Kansas. That's it for tonight's show. Tune in next week. Our show is going to be about ERISA's demise, the domino effect on pensions, and Huelga, a story from a casino utility closet. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock, right here on 90.1 FM, KKFI.